From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. There is just something about Texas. More perhaps than any other state in our nation, the Lone Star State has a strong sense of its own identity, which is rooted in the ideas of rugged individualism, self-reliance, individual liberty, and distrust of government. As one of the nation's top farming states, these ideas are really built into the culture of agriculture, too. But some of that ethos seems as though it might be at odds with a very big federal government program, the Federal Crop Insurance Program, in which taxpayers help make farmers whole when they lose crops or revenue. The program pays out tens of billions of dollars to farmers each year, and Texas is by far the biggest recipient of that money. There are a lot of reasons why farmers might ask to be reimbursed for crop losses, but one of the most common and commonsensical is drought. Payouts due to drought in Texas rose from an average of $251 million per year in the 2000s to $516 million per year in the 2010s to $1.1 billion per year in the first 4 years of the 2020s. That is more than twice the rate of inflation. And there may be plenty of good reasons for crop insurance, which is why it has long been a bipartisanly supported initiative of our government. But in a time of vast climate upheaval, a time in which places like Texas are being hit by increasingly long and severe droughts, there is good reason to ask whether the program needs to change. The nonprofit environmental working group is a good place to start for questions like these. And we're going to be talking today about its latest report on drought and crop subsidies in Texas. But it's important to note that the Lone Star State isn't alone. The same research organization recently released another report focused on the states of the Colorado River Basin. That report showed that at a time in which river flows have greatly diminished, in no small part, again, because of climate change, the crop insurance program had also paid out billions to farmers in that region. Ann Schechinger had a role in both of these reports. She is the Midwest director for the Environmental Working Group, and her work there explores agriculture's impact on the environment and analyzes how government policies impact agricultural production and can reduce agricultural pollution. Ann Schechinger, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And I think when we talk about these sorts of matters, it's really easy for people to get defensive. It's easy to conclude that critics, people who stand up and say, hey, you know, like maybe there's this thing that might not be working like we all want it to, that they're actually not critics. They're attackers. So I thought maybe we could start today just by addressing this common idea. Like, Ann, you don't hate farmers, right? You're not out to destroy American family farming.
We are definitely not out to destroy family farms or any farms in the U.S. We really do this work about crop insurance and other federal farm policy programs to make the programs better so that they work better for farmers as well as taxpayers that foot the bill for the majority of these programs. So we're not trying to attack anyone. We really just want to improve the program. There are major updates that need to be made to the crop insurance program in order to help farmers adapt to extreme weather from climate change.
A lot of people don't realize that we all support farmers in many ways with our tax dollars. It's a bit more indirect than, say, the way we support our teachers or police officers or the military or, you know, the people who build the roads that we collectively pay for. But there are some very major ways that the nation collaboratively works to provide for farmers. And one of these is the Federal Crop Insurance Program. Talk a little bit about the program, what it does, what it's intended to do.
So the program is a federally subsidized program, and it pays farmers when their crop yields or revenues decline. And a crop insurance premium is what farmers and taxpayers pay for a farmer to get a policy, and then an indemnity is what farmers receive when they have a reduction in crop yield or revenue. And so, you know, these premiums are highly subsidized by taxpayers. On average, premium subsidies paid by taxpayers are 63% of total premiums. So farmers only pay 37% of the actual cost of their crop insurance policy. And those indemnity payments then are made to farmers because of causes of loss that impact yield. So that's things like drought, heat, or excessive rain, as well as a decrease on the price side of farmer revenues, such as a decline in crop price. And at the end of the day, they get a payment if there's a, you know, a weather-related loss or a price-related loss. And since so many of the causes of loss that trigger these payments are related to weather, that's really why the crop insurance program is directly tied to climate change.
And here too, I want to say you're a longtime critic of this program's administration, but I've never seen anything that indicates that you think that there's no place whatsoever for crop insurance or even for taxpayer subsidization of crop insurance. You've simply suggested that there are some ways in which it is failing to create the best possible results in terms of food production and pollution reduction. And as you say, especially right now with these really transformative changes to regional climates.
That's definitely right. There's for sure a place for the crop insurance program in the U.S. and even a taxpayer subsidized crop insurance program. But what we advocate for is changes to the program, because right now, most of the funding from the crop insurance program goes to commodity crops. So farmers that don't grow, you know, fruits and vegetables and nuts. And a lot of the money also goes to these the largest farms in the U.S. So we advocate for reforming the program so that it's going to smaller farms that actually, you know, struggle financially and could use the taxpayer-supported help. But we think it's also really important to look at the program altogether and see how can we right now fix the program so that it's helping all farmers of commodity crops, of food crops, big and small, really adapt to extreme weather.
Okay, so let's now sort of hone in on Texas. There are two really big climate stories happening in the Lone Star State. One is increased spring rains in the eastern part of the state. These are deluges that mean just more water coming in really short time frames, which farmers will tell you, you know, they pray for rain, but not that kind of rain. And then the other one is, and this is the one that your recent report is really focused on, is these longer and more intense droughts, which are often centered in the western part of that state. That's where a lot of wheat is grown, onions, cotton. And drought in Texas is really what's driving a lot of the increases in crop insurance payouts, correct?
Yes. So drought is the number one cause of loss driving payments from the crop insurance program in Texas. So we did a recent analysis and we saw that between 2001 and 2022, drought paid out almost $10 billion to farmers in Texas. And that made up 43% of the total payments to farmers in the state from the crop insurance program. So it's not just that it's a lot of money, but it's also the major thing that's triggering these crop insurance payments in the state.
And the main crop involved here in Texas is cotton, which is a commodity crop. This is not something that ends up on people's tables.
That's exactly right. So the vast majority of drought payments in Texas were for just one crop, which was cotton. These farmers took in over $6.8 billion in drought payments. So that was 68% of the total drought payments in the state over this time. So this money is not going to farmers of a specific type of food crop. It's mainly going to farmers of cotton in Texas.
And I think a lot of people think about crop insurance, the crop insurance program, as sort of a national security program. But cotton, important as it is, 85% of the cotton produced domestically in the United States ends up overseas. So economically, certainly it can be argued that cotton is important. But this is a little different than wheat or rice or barley, which is also exported, but is also largely produced for domestic consumption and make sure that the United States has what it needs to feed itself if we need to do that.
Yeah, this is definitely not a food security issue. When so much money is going to cotton growers in Texas, then we know, you know, the crop insurance program in the state is not backing up food security to make sure everyone in America has enough to eat.
And that includes other forage crops that are covered by this program across the nation, but grown specifically to be grazed by livestock or increasingly converted into livestock feed, which is oftentimes most of it ends up overseas.
Yeah, there is a lot of crop insurance money that goes to farmers of corn, which we know goes to feeding cows, which a lot of the meat also goes overseas. And then there's also crop insurance money that goes to forage crops and grazing pasture land as well. And so that also would be used to raise these cows, in which the beef goes overseas at quite high levels.
And the crop insurance program is supposed to encourage adaptation to long-term changes in temperature and rainfall. That's actually built into the current statutes, but there are some people who've noted that it might not really be doing that. It might actually be insulating the farmers from market signals, which leads to growing crops on what might have been good lands at one time in history, but are increasingly marginal lands now.
Definitely. The crop insurance program really encourages farmers to grow on marginal land that is more vulnerable to extreme weather from climate change.
It just feels like the economist Adam Smith is like rolling over in his grave right now.
Yeah. I mean, this is a really heavily taxpayer subsidized program. And what's, I think, surprises a lot of people is that this really does impact and help farmers determine where they grow crops and what crops they grow. So this is not, our agriculture industry is not this industry where farmers just decide what they want to grow and base it off of market signals. A lot of it really is what are these government programs like crop insurance incentivizing farmers to grow.
And that's based on where farms have been for a long time, where climates have been sustainable to farming for a long time. And that is under some degree, a lot of degree of upheaval right now.
Definitely. There's a lot of change that we all know is happening because of extreme weather due to climate change. And that's going to impact greatly over the next few decades what farmers can grow and where they can grow these things. And this is particularly important in the Southwest and in Texas, where conditions are just getting very dry and essentially really hard to farm what farmers have grown for the past many, many decades.
And that's interesting the way you put that, because you say what they have grown for many, many decades. That doesn't necessarily mean that we need to say, well, you can't farm here at all anymore. It might just impact the decisions that we make about what we're growing, how we're growing, how we're irrigating. It might just mean that legacy farming has to change a little bit more. Yes?
That's a really important point. We're not saying that no one should be farming in Texas, in Colorado, in Utah, because that's not realistic. We still need those areas to farm so we have enough food, so we have enough commodity crops. But really what we need to be looking at is what can farmers feasibly produce in these dry areas in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So it's also not that we can't grow any cotton in Texas, but are there other conservation practices that we could be putting on these farm fields to still be able to produce cotton or another crop in this area, given much more dry conditions in the future?
This is a good segue to the Colorado River Basin. There's been a very big federal effort to get farmers in these states to install irrigation equipment that helps conserve water. That seems at first blush to be very much in line with this notion that part of the federal government's job is to help steer this industry into sustainability. But you've noted that this doesn't actually result in any overall savings to water, which sounds counterintuitive at first, until you realize something really important about the way water law and water allocation works in this region. Talk about that.
So the USDA has a conservation program called the Environmental Quality Incentives Program that pays farmers to install more efficient irrigation systems. And that seems like a really great idea in the Colorado River Basin and the Southwest states, because obviously there's not a lot of water there. The water is running out. And so reducing how much irrigation water is used would be really great. But a lot of the states in the Colorado River region have these water laws called use it or lose it water policies. And essentially, farmers that have really old and established water rights have to use their entire water allocation each year, or at least farmers believe they have to use this whole water allocation each year in order to maintain those water rights. So if we spend millions of dollars, which the USDA has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on irrigation equipment to improve efficiency in this region, it might not actually reduce water because farmers still have to use their whole water allocation every year in order to maintain those water rights.
You said that farmers believe they have to. How much of this is what the law actually says, and how much of it is perception or interpretation or worries about how the law might be interpreted in the future?
I think they both play in here. I think it depends on the state. You know, have there been a lot of cases where the government, state governments, are going after farmers who don't use their whole water rights? Not that I have seen. So it's possible that a lot of this is just a perception problem where farmers think they have to use their whole water allocation under use it or lose it laws in order to maintain it. And so it's a perception issue, but it also is a legal issue as well.
And all of this is bad enough if we just recognize that water consumption in the Colorado River Basin states has gone up as a result of population growth. But the other thing we have to layer on this is climate change. And in this region also, like Texas, we're seeing longer and more intense droughts.
We are definitely seeing way less water in the Colorado River itself, and also just more drought in the region, even just in the last few decades. So the fifth National Climate Assessment showed that the Southwest region, which is Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Utah, so not the whole Colorado River region, but most of it, was substantially warmer between 1991 and 2020 than during the preceding 30-year period. And they also described that there has been a mega drought in the region since 2000, and that between 2000 and 2022 was the driest 22-year period in over 1,000 years. So this region is definitely getting drier, and no one expects that trend to reverse anytime in the future.
And it's important to note there, I think, that we're talking about these climatologies, these like decades-long, 30-year-long periods, because a lot of people can get caught up in, you know, what happens in any given single winter. And in this region, the last couple of winters have been really wet, even historically wet, but the long-term trend, you put those together with 30 other past winters and you compare those to the 30 before and the 30 before that, the long-term trends are drier and drier and drier.
Yes, and there's also research showing that the Colorado River itself has lost a significant amount of water in the last few decades. So it's not just the drought conditions, but it's actually, you know, what's in the river as well. And then relatedly, there's research showing that, you know, the few aquifers, groundwater that does exist in this region, they're also losing water. So it's a compounding problem.
The undercurrent in both of these recent reports from your organization is that we need to begin moving toward insurance policies that are guided by these long-term shifts in climate. Talk a little bit about what that would look like.
There's so many things that could be changed about the crop insurance program that would really help farmers adapt to climate change. And it doesn't have to be, you know, one major change. It can be a lot of smaller changes that can help farmers encourage becoming more resilient to this extreme weather. Some of these potential reforms to the program could be something as simple as making sure that farmers can implement any USDA conservation practice on their farm and still qualify for crop insurance. So changing the legislation so that farmers can freely do conservation and still get a policy. And then another big part could be having the USDA really evaluate how crop insurance premiums are calculated that farmers and taxpayers pay so that those premiums better reflect the extreme weather that we're seeing due to climate change. Because right now, premiums are really based on historical crop yields and not so much on these weather extremes that we're seeing happen with more frequency.
So they're based on the last 100 years instead of what we suspect with lots of data and increasing data to be the case for the next 20 and 30 years.
So they're mostly based on the past 20 years of yields, but there's nothing in there about these weather conditions that we're seeing. And they have a lot of math and data. And so it makes sense to a lot of people, not just CWG, to include this weather data in their math and their databases to come up with better premium calculations.
One of the things that we know about climate change is that it is accentuating climate extremes and variability from year to year. So even having an idea of what's been happening in the last 20 years or setting something on an average about what we expect for the next 20 years might not be sufficient. And we may be still a little ways off from being able to do this, but could we also guide, for instance, the year-to-year prices for crop insurance on atmospheric and oceanic signals that can tell us a lot about coming interannual variability? Do you think that's part of the picture as well, where we'll be making year-to-year decisions on what policies can be issued based on the signals in our atmosphere and oceans?
I think that's definitely something that can be included in this. And it also brings up another really important reform, which would be changing the policy structure through the program so that it's not just focused on 1 year. It wouldn't just be, what do I have to do to reduce my risk and grow my crop this year? But what do I have to do in 5 years or in 10 years? And then having those longer term policies that would also make it even better to include the NOAA and other weather data into the crop insurance premium rating process.
One of the complicating factors in having these discussions is that when Americans close their eyes and they picture a farmer, the framing that many of us, probably most of us, have in their head is sort of this idealistic, you know, Paul Harvey and God created a farmer kind of ideal. But there's this other wrinkle in this that you and your group have pointed out in the past, which is that a third of crop insurance subsidies aren't going to mom and pop farmers. They're flowing to insurance corporations and their agents. They're going to very rich landowners. They're even going to people who don't even live on the farms where they're claiming their losses, people who live on golf courses and in beach houses and in penthouse city apartments. Those are often the recipients of these payments.
You know, when you read children's books about farms, you see a farmer that has maybe a few acres of corn and then also some fruits or vegetables and a few cows, a few pigs. But that's not who benefits from these programs. They really go to the largest and wealthiest farms, not small farms, and mostly to commodity crop growers. So the people who produce corn and soybeans and cotton in many places. So it's a really important thing to note about these programs that they mostly are not benefiting the farmers that need the help the most.
What is the most important reform you foresee right now? Like, if I said, Ann, I'm going to snap my fingers and you're going to have total and complete control over the crop insurance program for the next hour, what do you do? What is the one thing?
I guess I have two things. I do think it's really important to put that weather data in premium rating, including weather data into how crop insurance policies are determined. And then I also think what would be really important is reducing the incentives, the subsidies to farmers who farm on marginal land. So that's a really big problem here in the Midwest along the Mississippi River, is farmers that are farming in floodplains because their crop insurance program and other farm subsidy programs makes that profitable. It makes it possible. So I think if we were to reduce some of the incentives in the crop insurance program for farmers who farm in floodplains and other really vulnerable areas, that would be really beneficial to the climate and to farmers.
That's Ann Schechinger. She's the Midwest Director for the Environmental Working Group, and her work there explores agriculture's impact on the environment and analyzes how government policies impact agricultural production and can reduce agricultural pollution. Ann, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.